Hotter Than Ever is brought to you by Broad Collective, a membership network for professional women pivoting to self-employment in midlife. Maybe you've been dreaming of starting your own business, or you already work for yourself. In Broad Collective, you'll find the strategy, peer support, tools, and practical resources you need to take ownership over your career, connect with your target audience, scale your business, and grow your income doing the work you love. Creating meaningful content is the best way to get the word out about who you are and what you do. But most solopreneurs don't have a strategy for how to use social media, AI, podcasting, newsletters, self-publishing, public speaking, and all the other media channels available to us today to make the biggest possible impact. In Broad Collective, our members learn from each other and from experts how to turn their expertise into revenue and how to do it joyfully by leaning into our strengths. Whether you're an established entrepreneur or just starting out, as a Broad Collective member, you don't have to grow it alone. Go to broadcollective.com for more information and apply today. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, where we uncover the unconscious rules we've been following, we break those rules, and we find a new path to being freer, happier, sexier, and more self-expressed. I'm your host, Erin Keating. Today, I talk to writer Margot Steinis about her memoir, Brutalities. This conversation may be disturbing to some folks, so please consider yourself warned. Because it goes into all of the different ways that Margot sought to get relief from her emotional pain by putting her body through painful trials and various kinds of abuse as a young woman. You know, we all work through our stuff in different ways, but Margot sought out drugs and sex work and sexual violence, in addition to bad men and bad relationships and reinventing herself as a union welder, which you'll hear in the podcast, I was really proud of her for. She has come out the other side and she has written this gorgeous, gorgeous book as a way of trying to make sense of it all. Margot really brought out my tender side. Take a listen. Margot Steinis is a widely published writer. She's a faculty member in the University of Arizona's writing program, and she is the author of the memoir in essays, which is like my favorite form, Brutalities, a Love Story, which we are going to get into on the podcast today. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, Margot.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am so happy to have you here to talk about this book, which is both gorgeous and disturbing. I want to go in through the shallow end, because we are going to get to the deep part. But how would you describe what this memoir is about?
It is about physical extremity broadly, and I think a troubled relationship with the body.
Yeah, I mean, what woman does not have a troubled relationship with the body?
One of the subtitles for one of the chapters is A Body That's Been Troubled. And I took it from one of my professors in graduate school was trying to sort of like gently talk about how I treated myself. And that was the line she used.
It's very delicate,
yeah, very
given
delicate.
Some of what you write about. It's so gorgeous and it's so uncomfortable. And here's what your fellow author and memoir in essays writer, Kelly McMasters, wrote about this book. And I just thought it was so spot on. She says, Brutalities is a book about bodies and violence and beauty and want. It is a book that is sharp and painful as a fleck of hot metal embedded in skin. It is a book that is soft as a womb. It is a book whose essay and sentence structure make me want to rip it apart at the seams, strip it down to sinew and bone to understand how it works. The BDSM, the MMA, the DV, the smelting, all the pain in this book is outshined in the end by mercy. There's so little of it in this world. Do you
That's
think
so
she got
well
it right?
Said. Yeah, for sure. I think I love Kelly, and I think that she read this book, you know, the way that I hoped it would be read.
I think we start the sort of beginning of your coming of age in New York. So you were born and raised in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. You were a private school, boarding school girl from a good family. And yet, like a lot of us in our teenage years, you were always searching for something else.
Yeah, and I was wild.
Yeah, let's hear about that a little bit, because I do love the wildness of teenagers. But as a person whose twins are turning 13 tomorrow, this is terrifying to me.
Yeah. Yeah, to me too. I'm like, oh man, I hope that generationally I got all the wildness out. You know, I think there are a lot of different ways to look at the way I was. I mean, I think a honest but reductive take is that I was really depressed at a really young age, and the conversation about mental health, certainly for kids, was not, you know, where it's at now. And, you know, I wanted to feel something. I didn't really feel anything other than discomfort most of the time. Mm. And I was really checked out and, you know, just kind of unhappy, you know. And at the time, you just called a girl troubled, right? If you like didn't eat right and were sad, that was the term for you. So I was that. And then, you know, I grew up in Manhattan, so there's like a lot of fun trouble to get into. I think if I grew up somewhere else, I would have just been like a teen mom. God, I'm like, probably just, not, because, yeah. Right. Well, you know, there's like, it is location specific, the kind of trouble you can get into. And, you know, New York, LA, et cetera, there's the trouble is different. And so the kind of trouble I got into is I spent a lot of time hanging out with men. I was really into the clubs and I was really into drugs. And I liked all of that. And I liked money. I started working as a sex worker when I was 17. And that felt completely normal to me. And it kind of took off from there.
You describe walking down the street, particular street in the Village, and how these guys would catcall to you and how one of them sort of recognized something in you and pursued you to enroll you into this life.
Yeah, for sure. And like, to be clear, there was nothing particularly special about me that I was receiving all this attention. Like, we all got it. It was just like what it is to be. I mean, I was like young, white, and thin. That's like all it really takes, and probably not even that.
And privileged too, right? Like, you could probably see that on you.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Though, you know, I didn't grow up wealthy, but like definitely privileged. Like, I went to private school. My dad's a professor, but the kind of schools I went to, people were like Dubai rich, you know? So like we were not that. But, that's, you know, hilarious. I was well educated and I had a lot of access to privilege. And, you know, I had a lot of access to mental health care and the kind of things that come with that. But at the time, like, I didn't want to be well. I wanted to wild out. And so when this gross biker was like, hey, you're pretty, do you want a job? I was like, yeah, love a job. I wanted my own money, you know, because money for me represented the ability to make my own decisions. And I didn't really care what I had to do to get it. I just wanted to be in charge of myself. Mm.
And when you say you became a sex worker, can you say specifically what that is?
Yeah. So I started as a professional dominatrix, and I worked when I began at a dungeon in the old armory building on 20 something street.
At 17?
Yeah.
So there's a market for 17-year-old dominatrix.
You know, it was not, I mean, it was like much better when I was 18, but I think he knew I was going to be good at making money. And, you know, it was like, what's a year? And I looked a little older than I was and was good at carrying myself that way. Yeah, no, it wasn't like a seeking minors kind of situation. It was kind of, you have to be young enough to be stupid enough to work for this man. That's the thing. Yeah, it was not a good job. I, you know, I stayed in the industry for 10 years and, you know, eventually worked for myself and had better jobs, but that was just like not a great situation.
So how did you go from being paid to inflict pain to wanting to experience feeling the pain yourself?
Well, so I met this man who used to come into mine and some of the other dungeons to like beat the girls up. And he was young and very attractive.
Because that was fun for him. That was
like his thing. Okay. And, you know, he didn't want to like, he wanted to do it in a consensual situation, but also he was totally fucking unhinged. So it's like, that's hard to find in like the dating space, you know? and so he would come in and he was like, you know, there were these clients that were always like famous clients to all the girls who worked. Like, there was the guy who wanted to get his teeth pulled out, and there was the guy that brought the bag of sweaters, and then there was like the hot guy that beat the girls. And so
And then you're like, that's the one for
me.
I
was like, I want to marry him.
God.
Yeah.
The more conservative and pearl clutching of the listeners to this show. You know, we're talking about this in a really normal and casual way. I think because these are experiences that women have. And, you know, Margo, this is your real life story and we're laughing about it. But it is this heavy duty to be in an environment, to be so young and to be in an environment and to know that this guy, like, his thing is to come in and beat the girls up. Like,
yeah,
that's
absolutely
a shocking statement. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And why was I like, oh, I want to spend time with him? Because I think, I mean, a more well-adjusted person probably wouldn't have been there. I mean, I don't think that sex work is necessarily, I think there's like a safe and sane way to do sex work, but that's not how I was doing it. I was young and doing a lot of cocaine and trying to have kind of dodgy experiences. And I'm very lucky and had a lot of privilege as a sex worker and also just a lot of luck that I did not have come to worse harm than I did.
Yes, I'm so glad that you didn't.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say because there's so many people, you know, who are working, doing survival work and not having access to that kind of safety.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, so this guy, he's very charismatic. There were a lot of reasons to find him exciting, and I did. And I started spending time with him, and he sort of, I mean, you know, I was like very happy to be there. So like there was no coercion involved, but I don't think groomed is like too far off a word for like what happened there. And so I sort of molded myself into someone that liked what he liked. And then after enough years, I was like, oh shit, this feels like it's now settled in and has become me. And I found that, you know, I had been trying to have all these experiences with drugs and with, I had terrible eating disorders, trying to get out of myself. So it's like S&M is a great way to get out of yourself because it, you can have these physically extreme experiences where you just, it's the only thing that you can think about. So I was into that. And
it's very focusing.
Yeah. Very focusing. Yeah. Very, very focusing. And also, you know, I had no idea how to manage my life on a daily or macro level. So someone telling me what to do was like ideal. You know, I think what I really needed was a fucking life coach. But instead, I got this guy like telling me that I should do less cocaine, like, you know, get another job. Yeah. Yeah. He and I eventually became serious, and that part of our relationship ceased to be like the center of it, I guess. But by that time I had really, like, my own life had gone in that direction, and I was seeking these experiences on my own. And, you know, I continued to work in the industry until my late 20s.
And were you writing this whole time, or were you just thinking about writing?
No, I briefly tried to go to college when I was like 18 or 19. And at that time I was like, oh, I'm an English major. Like, I want to be a writer. And I realized like that I kind of knew I had wanted to be a writer, but it just, I would only let it out for a little bit at a time. And I met this really amazing professor who told me I was a writer. He told me I should write something. He was so fun. He like was one of the first people to kind of take me seriously. And he remains a friend. And so I wrote a bunch of stuff, but then I was like doing drugs and couldn't stay in school. And that was really the peak unmanageability of my life at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was no room for a creative life in that.
No, it takes a lot of work to maintain a drug habit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Especially in New York City.
And it's a different kind of focus than sitting in front of a blank screen.
For sure. And I also, you know, I didn't realize this at the time, but I had no capacity to be honest with myself. And the kind of work I do as a writer is like that. That's what we're doing here.
Yes.
And
very
I couldn't, I was unable and unwilling to do that.
Wasn't that interesting that like, that's a skill? Mm-hmm. Like to learn how to be honest with yourself is a skill, because somehow there's all these like masks, these layers of masks that we even wear to protect ourselves from our own thoughts, or that's what we think we're doing.
Yeah.
It's so profound.
Yeah. And I think it's a life's work. You know, I mean, if I look at even just like my written work from 10 years ago, there were these plot holes in it. And like, it's nonfiction, you know, it's not like a generated narrative, but the plot holes were like, I couldn't see the truth about my life. And, you know, I wonder if in 10 years, like I'll see that in this book. And I kind of hope so, because it means that I'm evolving as a person. But, you know, you make something and it's static, it's printed on paper and it doesn't change. But, you know, I hope that I can see more in 10 years than I see today.
Yeah, in my experience, it's been a gift of aging where it's no longer quite as threatening to see the truth, because you're like, well, I got this far. I got through that, you know, and maybe if I tell the truth, I can figure out how to be happier, more fulfilled than I was when I was lying.
Yeah.
But we do hide from ourselves.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah. So you were with this guy for a long time. You were still doing sex work and you lived on a farm in upstate New York. And there were a lot of rough things going on there too. A lot of death, a lot of animals, a lot of, like, I think about Manhattanites who, or Brooklynites who move up to the Hudson River Valley or that area of the world where it is really rural. Like, it is not a joke. It is cold as shit in the winter. It is brutal. And you were like, we're homesteaders. We're hardy. We're hardcore. We're going to do this. Yeah. It sounds like there were a lot of trials as part of that experience as well.
Yeah, for sure. And we were like, to be clear, not in the cute Hudson Valley. We were like hours north and west of there where,
where it gets even less glamorous. Yeah.
Yeah. Where like people don't have teeth. And it is hard as a city person to be like, can I blend here? Can I? I don't, you know, it was like, and I think in Kelly McMaster's book, she writes so well about that, about like coming to rural life and like being like, am I a snob? Like, I was like assaulted by the reality that I was a snob. But, you know, also the relationship that I was in was volatile and isolating and, you know, not the kind of thing you want to take to the woods. And yeah.
No,
but you know, that was his thing. Everything we did was his thing. He was really great at, he's really great at ambition. And he, if he has an idea, he doesn't have the skills to do it, he just learns them on the way. And he's very good at doing stuff. So he bought this land, he bought this house, and eventually he let me move up there with him. And I was just like, I would go anywhere he went. And at that point I had been working as a welder for some years. So I like knew how to work with my hands and I thought it would be helpful. And then it turned out like I wasn't very helpful and it wasn't very good. And
yeah. So let's talk about you being a welder, because you are not a big person. You're not like a burly.
Aaron, I'm strong.
I know. I read your book.
Yeah. No, I'm like a tiny woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you are small and, but your will is so intense, especially when you write. I was really struck in you writing about becoming a journeyman iron worker and how the precision of that work and the exacting nature of it, the physical nature of it, the material nature of it, the metal and the heat and all of that was so visceral and so exacting, but maybe in a way that was productive for you.
Yeah.
Like, even though it was punitive and you were the only woman most of the time and you had to take a lot of shit and eat a lot of shit, that felt like, oh, I was reading the book and I was thinking, oh, she's making progress.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you. I was proud of you.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wanted a vanilla job, or like, as we call it, a civilian job. Mostly because
sex workers call it vanilla or civilian. Yeah.
Yeah. Mostly because my boyfriend at the time was just made fun of me so much. And I really wanted him to take me seriously. And at this point, I was in like my mid-20s when I learned to weld. I had gotten sober. I was like starting to confront the realities of living with the long-term stigma of sex work. And because I had started so young, I had no job history on paper anywhere that I could ever point to and to get an apartment, anything. There was just like a lot of...
Your LinkedIn profile did not track.
No. I was like, I walk dogs. That was like the best I could do.
I've been a babysitter.
Yeah. It's like, but they're humans. Yeah. So I was like kind of wanting to enter civilian life. But a lot of it was spurred by, I knew that, you know, my boyfriend was embarrassed of me and he was not nice about it. And I was like, okay, like, what can I do?
Even though he met you in that context.
That's right. He was a steel contractor, very successful, you know, had built his own business and just thought he was so cool. He was very cool. That part was not untrue, but I really worshiped him. And I was like, oh, you know, do you think that I could do this work? And I thought he was going to call me stupid. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. I'll help you get started. You know, I think this would be great for you. And he did. He helped me get my first job. And, you know, later, like, helped me get some other jobs. Like, he really did help me transition out of sex work for not entirely good reasons, but, like, ultimately it was good for my life. And then I got a union book and, you know, that helped a lot because it's a lot more money. And I was like, oh, I have health insurance for the first time since I had my parents' health insurance and stuff like that. So anyway, when I had a job that, you know, you can talk about it at brunch and not become the focus of conversation.
Although I think you'd probably still be the focus of conversation.
Yeah.
Because you were
It's a little less interesting.
But you were climbing up giant office buildings that were being built and welding in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was I'm like, I don't know if I could do that job right now. It's like, that shit was scary. But at the time, I was so much more afraid of being embarrassed or being seen as not tough enough to do the work that I was never afraid of falling off the building and dying. I was like afraid of Jimmy and whoever, like thinking I was stupid. So, you know, I worked really hard and I remade myself. Having only ever made money on my sex appeal, I was like, I'm not going to carry this into this new work. I wanted it to be clean of that. And so I shaved all my hair off and I dressed myself in like layers of Carhartt pants and tried to like really disappear any femininity and desexualize myself. Because I wanted to have an experience where I was like, what can I do without that? You know, right. And I think I had never had that. Even my professor friend who supported me so much, I'm like, did he also want to sleep with me? Like, maybe, you know, it's like, maybe not. But like, that was always the question, as it sounds like such a privileged thing to complain about. But being like a young, hot girl, like everybody wants to sleep with you. And so you never know whether you have anything valid underneath that. Mm. And I really wanted to know, like, whether I could do something without that. And so I tried to.
You're attracted to extremes, though, Mark.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Well, I remember being like, I could be a carpenter, but that doesn't seem as tough.
Well, it isn't as tough. It's just saws and shit. This is this is fire. Molten metal.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. It's like, instead of approaching life with a sort of surgical, strategic way of pursuing these changes and this evolution, or even a like organic way of one thing leads to the next, you just take such huge swings from one extreme to another extreme. I'm not a psychologist and I don't know how this shit works. I know that I was impacted by how I was raised and my relationship with my family, my parents, and the family unit. Do you prescribe any of your characteristics to how you were raised? I am constantly fascinated by the nature-nurture question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, for sure. You know, I can look back and say I was uniquely sensitive in a specific way, and that intersected with ways that my family was and led to XYZ. But I have a brother and a sister, and they are different than me. But there's like birth order and, you know, all of that. I'm sure if I had grown up in a different family, I would have been a different person, but like, that's true of anyone. I do think that these erratic reinventions of myself were from really just not knowing who I was, you know? So it was like, I was just trying to fill a container of a person and see if something fit. So it was less about my own desire than it was just being like, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And I think I did grow up, I think I just like received things really poorly, like things that were not bad, but like I went to this really sweet, crunchy private school, very similar to the one I send my kid to, where, you know, there were no grades and we talked about our feelings and all of that. And like, I think I really needed I don't know about not that, but like, I did not need to be told again how special I was. Like, I was told that too much. Mm. And I think I needed like a little less of that.
And a little more structure.
Yeah, like maybe a little more structure. And like, we also like, neurodivergence wasn't really a topic then. And I haven't pursued diagnosis, but I'm pretty sure that something's going on here. And I think I also needed a level of mental health intervention that was very different than the one I received. And then the other thing is I was heavily medicated as a young adolescent with psychiatric medication. And I do actually think that that profoundly affected, and not for the better, you know, the trajectory of my life, because I was taking all these pills and nothing felt like anything. So I was like, yeah, like punch me in the face, whatever. Like nothing feels like anything. And not really understanding that the functions of my psychology and biology were being disrupted by a bunch of shit that had never been studied on young people.
And yeah, and what does it mean to take away that tumultuous period of growth and self-discovery in your early teen years?
Totally.
Where you're trying to figure out where you fit, and you're trying to figure out how things feel, and you're feeling like shit half the time, yeah. And then you're ecstatic half the time. And like, I mean, this is my life, so I relate to this very deeply. We are just on an emotional roller coaster in my house all the time. But I watch my children figuring out who they are, and I see their healthy evolution from trying to be one thing to being more self-accepting, and trying out different identities and approaches to how to live and how to do school and how to be friends. And it's a heady time. And if you're numb to all of that, what does that do?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't believe in boarding school as an institution. I don't think that's the age.
Having gone there.
Live alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And like, some people do fine with it. You know, I mean, probably most of the people I went to boarding school with are very successful and work in fintech.
Definition of success.
Yeah. But, you know, certainly they didn't, you know, most people didn't struggle the way I did. I had to be taken out of there to a psychiatric hospital. But looking back, I'm like, a 13-year-old is very young and
very
not young. Really, I don't think, equipped to be living solo.
Yeah. That's got to be hard. That's got to be lonely.
Yeah, I think it was. I don't really remember. I just remember having so much social anxiety that I didn't really like perceive anything else. But I had wanted to go. It wasn't like my parents booted me out. But also, like, I was 13. You know, it's like,
right. What decisions do you let your 13 year old? Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And they, you know, they were not otherwise permissive parents. So it was sort of a strange, I think it was just like a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
They did their best. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't their best moment.
In so many ways in this book, your identity and your life is lived through your body. And I think a lot of women can really relate to that, where we are our bodies out in the world, mm-hmm. right? We are judged first on our bodies and assessed and categorized based on our bodies. But you pushed your body through so many trials, and I'm so interested to hear, you know, this latest chapter of your life. Well, maybe we'll just have you read a little bit from the beginning of Brutalities.
Yeah. So this is from the opener to the book. I am 37, pregnant, in love, and effectively locked in my apartment. In April, the temperature nears the record high in Tucson, the southern Arizona desert town that has become my home. I did not intend to land in the Southwest. I was just stopping by for a few years to earn a graduate degree before heading back to Hawaii, where I had settled. And yet now I live here, nestled between the Catalina, Tortolita, Santa Rita, and Rincon mountain ranges, on a dusty alluvial plain tucked into great expanses of red voters and stabby cacti and desert creatures that hiss and howl at night. On my couch sits my reason for staying here. His hair, nearly black, curls around his ears as he squints to read something on his phone screen. Strong and gentle and wise, the person I spent so many years of my life stumbling around looking for. Our baby will be born at the end of the summer, into three-digit temperatures and monsoon rains. My apartment is a collection of white objects nesting inside more white. White sheetrock living room, bedroom, and bathroom containing white modular shelves, white appliances, white table, white chairs. I keep the gauzy white curtains pulled tight against the Arizona sun at all times of the day. I keep the surfaces as clean as possible. I fold and crumple the golden cranes. Inside this small, tidy world, I can maintain order. N works as a coach and trainer for athletes. I watch a muscle on the back of his arm rise as he shifts around on the couch. So much of the story of his life is visible in his body, a solid mass of strength and damage, a collection of experiences and reactions and corrections. A football lineman, a gymnast, a fighter. When he moves, body parts I didn't used to know about rise and ripple. Rear deltoids, latissimus dorsi, trapezius. He is a father, a son, a man, a boy. The parts of him I love most fiercely are the soft ones that balance all his strength, his gentleness, his open heart, his eyes that make and keep contact. In the apartment, we sit with our limbs tangled up, a bowl of berries balanced between us on my knee. I never liked sharing anything until I met him. Always preferred my own space, my own bowl, my own chair. Now I like everything being both of ours. I like sanding down the rough spots of my rigidity, my stubbornness, my ways of being that have ossified over 3.5 decades of holding carefully together the boundaries of my heart. Inside our apartment, I feel safe and loved. Mm.
It's so gorgeous. And it's not like a man is the solution or the like, and then I got a guy who was really nice and hot and then we're done. Now, end of scene. Like, I think for me, we all have romantic fantasies and this is a beautiful fulfillment. But also, I think it's really interesting how so much of the way that you talk about him is located in his physicality and located in the fact that he is an MMA fighter and trainer. And like, that's got to be a place where you guys connect. Like, you could never write him. You could never conjure him or invent him, right?
Yeah.
But it seems to track so beautifully in the story of you and the way in which you're healing. I'd love to hear your reflections on that.
Yeah, I mean, the culture of our relationship and now our family is very much a physical culture. He has had, you know, in many ways, like a more extreme relationship with his own body than I have, but like much more functional also. And well, he's a third generation martial artist, and what he's doing, and especially what he was doing when he was younger, when he was training to fight, is like on one hand, one of the most dangerous things you can do. And he did suffer like a life altering injury. But then on the other hand, it's like measured and intentional and it's not unhinged in the way that I was doing stuff.
Right.
And it's part of like a lineage of knowledge and, you know, there's a ethic that goes along with it. So like, that's a lot of what my book is about, is like that the things we're actually doing with our limbs can look the same, but like they mean very different things in different contexts. And he's not someone that was ever like fighting people at bars. It means a different thing to him.
There's a nihilism to the way in which you used your body in a lot of the different sort of phases of your life, a sort of like seeking obliteration, seeking that focus, that single place to put all the feeling and all of the extreme sensitivity and all of that stuff. Does he have that too, or has he sort of transmuted it through the practice of martial arts?
I mean, I think he had a different version of it when he was younger. He doesn't have the same thing I have, no, but I think he has some of the same stuff, and he sort of responded to it with discipline. And he's also into stuff, like he was like a, I don't even know what you call it. He was a skier when he was young, where you like go off the ledges and do the flips and stuff. Like he's like a roller coaster guy. Do you know what I mean? Like he likes that feeling. And I'm not. I'm like absolutely fucking not. That shit is scary. And so I don't know exactly how to like articulate the difference between those two things, but I think it's like I was seeking harm, you know, and he is seeking some kind of I don't know, like metaphysical something. So I think they're like similar, but not the same. I think his shit is less dark than mine.
That was like, the impression I got.
A little more hell. And I think he's also, you know, we've both worked on ourselves a lot in very different ways over the years. But I think that he started doing that work earlier and is like a little further along that path than I am. Mm-hmm.
How has motherhood changed your relationship with your body?
So much, you know, in some ways, like a cliche that I was not thrilled to embody. But yeah, I mean, and it's hard to say too, because so I got pregnant with my child after a long, long time of being told I would never have a child, or that, you know, I would need to do lots of IVF and stuff. I got pregnant with my kid. My mystery chronic illness ramped up and became something that I realized was going to be with me for quite a while. And then the pandemic happened, like all at once. And so, yes, my relationship to my body has changed a lot. And all of those things together have contributed to that. But I will say that being pregnant was, I think, the first time I ever treated myself with like real kindness and care, you know, and I had replaced like the harms of my eating disorder and these men who were mean to me and drugs with discipline and rigor that was still like so fundamentally violent, you know, which is like compulsive exercise and just, you know, all of this thing where I had to earn the privilege to just like be alive, you know, with myself. And then when I was pregnant, I noticed the absence of a lot of that because my body was for my kid. So like if it needed to eat, I would feed it. And like I just like wasn't so crazy with exercise. Not because I didn't want to be, but because I was like afraid of killing the baby. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and then I was like, oh, this is kind of nice. It's like, you have a snack, you have a nap. and, you know, I also, my kid is 3.5 and I still body feed them. So, you know, making milk has been, I have to drink water. I have to have food. The milk production is like very much governed by the health of the milk maker. So in some ways, like we're still in this symbiotic biological relationship where I'm like, the sandwich that I eat is making the milk for you.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard body feed. I heard chest feeding when I talk to someone who has a brother who's trans.
Yeah.
Body feed is the inclusive way.
Yeah. I think body feeding and chest feeding are like analogous. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I just try to remember like we're not all moms. Not all of us have breasts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. And so much possibility and change lives inside of language.
Totally.
I think your book is a testament to that and reflects that so deeply. And part of the reason I wanted you to read an excerpt from the book is just to reassure readers that you're okay.
Yeah, I'm you know, good.
Because I was worried about you. Yeah. Reading the book, and I think it's so smart that you included that in the very beginning so that, you know, when you see a performer who's on stage and you're like, they're not steady up there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I think it's so important with the narrator too. Like you want to know who you're with, and like if you're with someone who's unhinged, that's a very different relationship to have as a reader, you know? And like, I don't really think that that describes me any longer. I'm your mom friend now, you know? But also I did all that other shit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the best kind of mom friend who hasn't always been like, you know, what she looks like in the daycare line.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question that I ask everyone on the podcast, which is, are there any deal terms in your life, any sort of agreements that you've been living by that you want to renegotiate? I think we act like once we decide something, it's forever, or things are more fixed than they actually are.
Oh man, that is a really good question.
Thank you.
I think a lot of my understandings of myself are things that I'd like to, you know, put up for an annual review. You know, I think I worked so hard to understand myself at all that once I did, it was like, okay, let me hold on to that. Right. Mm. And I have changed so much as a person. And like laterally, like some for the better, some for the worse in the last certainly like 4 years. And I would like to not remain fixed, you know, in who I am now or like trying to be who I was 3 years ago. Like that just feels so harmful to the project of like being honest. And I do feel sometimes a lot of friction between being like, I was like that, especially like with my health, you know, I can't do the stuff I used to be able to do. And that is so painful sometimes. And I feel like so much of my identity was wrapped up in what I used to be able to do. And now just trying to like be good with myself, how I am today.
Yeah. I don't imagine that you will stay fixed? Because it seems to me like you've been on a journey of constant reinvention.
Yeah.
And I don't think that stops just because we find a wonderful partner and have a child and sort of take on the mantle of conventional life. Mm-hmm. I just think it gets harder to see it sometimes.
Uh-huh.
You know, we are always changing, but motherhood and conventional life conspires to keep us fixed.
For sure.
I just don't think you're going to settle for that.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on the show, Margo.
Thanks
really
for
enjoyed
having
this
me.
Conversation.
Me too.
Take care of yourself.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Hotter Than Ever. If you have been enjoying this podcast, please go over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. Your honest, heartfelt feedback means the world to me personally, and the more great reviews we have, the more people will be able to find this show and join this conversation about what it means to be hot and vital and self-expressed and full of joy and optimism and all the deep wisdom and insight that you have earned by making it to this phase of your life. If you want to reach out to the show, please DM us on Instagram at HotterThanEverPod. And if you're looking to ask an advice question that I will answer in my most opinionated and unqualified way, you can call and leave a voicemail or text your question to 323-844-2303. Hotter Than Ever is produced by Erica Gerard and Podkit Productions. Our associate producer is Melody Carey. Music is by Chris Keating, with vocals by Isa Fernandez. Come back next week for more advice and interviews with incredible women. We need each other, ladies. We need these conversations. That is what I'm hearing from you when you write in with feedback about the show. I am here for it. Talk to each other, listen to this podcast, share it with your friends. Make it a starting point for a conversation about what you can do to make your life the best it can possibly be. Get inspired. That's my message. Get inspired. I'm going to help. Don't worry. I won't leave you hanging.